Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Rhodes Podcast. And it's episode number 3. I think you're really going to be excited about this one. We've got a great topic today. We're going to give out some great information. My name's Kristen Campbell. I'm the strategy officer here at Ingham County Medical Care Facility on Dobie Road. And I've got my awesome podcast partner, Jill, with me today. Hi, Jill.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Introduce yourself and then our guest for today, please.
I am Jill Clauser. I am a social worker and a home care and hospice consultant for Advisa Care. And we have invited one of my folks I just love and worked with for many years at the law office, Susie Chalgen. And we're going to let her answer a lot of the questions that have come up over the last couple podcasts. And I think you will enjoy her.
Yeah. Welcome, Susie.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
And tell us a little bit about you. You're an attorney, obviously, with Chalgen and Tripp. And how long have you been an attorney and how long have you been at Chalgen and Tripp?
So I have been an attorney and at Chalgen Tripp over 10 years now.
Okay.
My dad also works there. It's a family business to some sense. So I've been at Chalgen Tripp since the beginning in some ways. And I've been around what is the specialty of our firm that whole time. So we do elder law, we do special needs planning, we do probate and estate planning, and then we do litigation within the probate realm. So grew up in it, love it to death, and have really enjoyed being an attorney.
Awesome. Well, I'm so happy you're here. I think you're going to offer a lot of resources for our listeners today. So we're going to go ahead and just get started here. So the first question I have for you is, what do you feel like are the top 3 or 4 documents that everybody should have as they get older?
So I would say most people come in for estate planning, really preparing for what happens when they pass away. And that is important, and especially to certain individuals, something that they care a lot about. For me, I like to shift the conversation more towards estate planning documents that are focused on what happens while you're alive, but maybe in a vulnerable or incapacitated situation.
Okay.
A lot of people don't think about you can become disabled in the blink of an eye.
Yes, right.
And we, because we deal on the other end of it, see that all the time. So the minute you become 18, you don't have anyone who can step in and make decisions for you. So power of attorneys are that. It's you controlling what happens in that instance. If I'm a 20-year-old at college and I have a medical event that lands me in a coma, my parents are probably going to want to make decisions about what happens to my body, my treatment, my care, as well as any resources that I had in order to pay for my care. That would take a medical power of attorney, which is the document that says, this is who's going to take care of me, make decisions about my body, about my care and treatment. And then a financial power of attorney would be the person who's able to access resources that are in that individual's name and utilize those for the support of the individual. So this can come up at any age, but obviously it's important in those big instances of disability or as we see people getting older. If they're slowly declining with cognitive ability, power of attorneys become huge as far as the support. And a lot of times people are fearful of power of attorneys mm-hmm. because they see it as I'm giving this power to someone else. But the reality is it's not giving away any power. In fact, you're controlling something that you otherwise wouldn't control.
Right.
Like I always think of it like, you know, if you don't do anything, it's the court and they have their priority and that might not be who your priority is, mm-hmm. but they don't know what you would want.
Mm-hmm.
So this is your way of telling people, this is what I would want. And not only are you naming people, but you're telling them what to do. The document describes, these are the decisions I hope that you make. And I don't have to tell you exactly what the outcome will be,
mm-hmm.
which this is where I should mention, Michigan doesn't do living wills, which is like a, if this, then that. But we do as a medical power of attorney. So we say, I want these decisions to be made by my medical person, and that includes maybe end of life. So while I'm not telling them to pull the plug, I am giving them the option to decide if that's the quality of life that I'd want. So there's a lot in those documents that's very personal, very tailored to individuals, and a lot of control and peace of mind can be put into those documents. So to me, most valuable, hands down, for you, your adult children, everything.
Yeah, great advice, I think, especially as parents transition from your kid living at home and, you know, all those kind of things to going off to college. It just should be part of what you do for college prep, really, is to get that in place. Because you're right, you never know. And that's, you least, that's, you don't expect that, right? So.
And isn't one of the fears
Susie, with Power Attorneys for Healthcare is that I'm giving up my decision, my right to make decisions. And can you talk about when that actually springs into effect?
Yes. So it is. It absolutely is. And the way people don't understand is you will always make your own medical decisions as long as you are capable. A medical power of attorney triggers when two doctors have stated that you don't have the capacity to make it. So that could be physical, right? I'm in a coma. I can't participate in the conversation. But it could also be a mental evaluation that you don't understand the choices anymore. So someone's stepping in. Yes, the medical is an or. That means if I name Jill as my power of attorney, I'm the person making decisions up until those two evaluations happen. And then she's going to make the decisions from that point forward because now I'm not able to anymore. So that is a little bit of giving up control, but only where you would have already lost it, right?
Correct. Yep.
The financial power of attorney can be written in two ways. One is that same trigger capacity, that evaluation of, okay, you don't have the capacity anymore to make those decisions. I prefer to write it as an immediate in most circumstances because an immediate power of attorney is an and. I always have the ability to make my own financial decisions. Until the court intervenes, I have the ability to access my resources and spend them how I want, which actually gets people in trouble sometimes, right? Yeah. And so if I have an immediate financial power of attorney, I can name Jill as my agent and she can act right away, but it doesn't take away my authority.
Okay.
And if I'm naming someone, hopefully I trust them. And if I'm declining mentally, having an individual who can come and kind of participate in management with me is such an easier slope to go down because yeah. Then it's not, hey, Susie, you don't have it anymore. You can't do this anymore. Mm-hmm. It's just like, hey, I'm going to do a little bit more for you because it seems like you need help balancing that checkbook.
Yeah. And I think it's also an opportunity for conversations with your loved ones where,
absolutely,
Mom, what are your accounts? What bills are concerning you? Because I think the older generation is very private about their finances.
Yes.
And I know you've had this experience where something happens and people are going through file cabinets and shoeboxes and trying to figure out
what's going on.
Figure out heads from tails of mm-hmm. what we actually do have and what mm-hmm. we're working with. So
yeah.
I'm amazed at how many spouses are in that situation, which I get it. Like a partnership works because you take the different shifts and you do your part. But yeah, there's a lot of people out there who just don't know what's available for that individual they want to support.
Yep. Makes sense. Interesting. Well, along that vein, can you talk a little bit about the difference between a will and a trust? And if you could, for just a brief little bit, get into the Ladybird deed. I know you get a lot of questions about that. So,
yep. So when you do power of attorneys, that's your I'm alive stuff, right? When you start to look at I've passed away, what documents would I need to distribute things the way I want? That's wills and trusts and Ladybird deeds. So estate planning, the traditional sense would be what happens to my stuff when I die? A big misconception about a will is that it avoids probate. A will is actually a direction to the probate court, and it just says, hey, here's what I want to happen, right? And a trust is a document that says, here's what I want to happen, and it's going to be in my own terms outside of the court. So a lot of times you hear people prefer a trust. It mainly is because you're stepping away from the probate court process and kind of creating your own instruction manual. It's a more complicated document. It costs more money to do one because it's very tailored to you, but it can make it more convenient, a little bit cheaper, all of those things. Trusts also are really valuable if you have a complicated distribution plan that you want. If you're not just giving things equally to your children, you've got little bits and pieces here. A great example would be you got a disabled child and you want to pass money as a special needs trust,
okay.
Right? That would be a reason to say, hey, this isn't so simple. We might want to do a trust to make sure that things are handled appropriately. Doesn't mean every disabled child needs a trust.
Right.
Just means that every time you add another factor, you're looking at that balance between probate court versus trust a little bit more.
Okay.
But there are other ways that people pass assets, right? Mm-hmm. Joint ownership is a big one. If you're married, the first one to die, most of the time you don't need anything to happen at all because you owned everything jointly and they just took, or beneficiary designation. It can pass directly through that.
Okay.
A Ladybird deed is a real property passes through deeds, right?
Yes.
And so if you want to name someone to inherit the property when you die, a Ladybird deed is a effectively like a beneficiary designation, because it says I'm going to own it with all of my rights as an owner throughout my lifetime, but immediately upon my death, it's going to transfer to this individual or these people.
Interesting.
So you really, you know, hate to come back to attorneys, but when you're looking at estate planning, you're sitting with your attorney, you're going through your assets, you're going through what you want to happen, and you're making a really organized plan. What's the best way to distribute these to those people? And what document do I need to do that? Probate court isn't that bad for a lot of situations. It gets a bad rap, but it can be an organized distribution. It might take a little longer. It might have a fee associated with it, but it might make sense for your estate.
Okay.
And then trusts, you might say, you know what, I value that because I have something different that I want. And Lady Bird deeds, I'd say, are very, very popular right now because they're a beautiful document for Medicaid purposes.
Okay.
And we can get into that in the long-term care conversation.
Okay.
But when you talk about Lady Bird deeds for estate planning, they're limited in what they can do for just estate planning. They're a little more complicated. And so I'd err towards really questioning that as part of your estate plan conversation if you don't expect to need Medicaid.
Okay. Interesting. Well, let's go down that road really quickly. If we're talking about Medicaid and, you know, here at Dobie Road, obviously one of the things that we specialize in is long-term care. Do people who really need to go into a nursing home, do they have to worry about losing their home? Or, you know, if you could talk a little bit about Medicaid recovery and how that all impacts the care that you might need someday.
Right. So finally, most people come in and their first concerns are about Medicaid taking something away, when the reality is, it's like, you're not even on the program yet. Slow down. Let's figure out if you should use the program or if you're eligible for the program.
Right.
But that's the fear, is that if I use long-term care in any sense, somehow Medicaid is going to get in the door without me asking, mm-hmm. and start to take. And that's just not the case.
Right.
Estate recovery is completely on the back end. It says you've been on the Medicaid program, you've utilized these resources, and we're talking specifically about long-term care Medicaid, not all those other Medicaid programs.
Yep. Because there's a difference. There's a difference between community Medicaid and nursing home, like long-term care Medicaid.
Absolutely. So, mm-hmm. There's so many programs under Medicaid,
yes.
that people don't realize how distinct they can
yes.
be. So long-term care Medicaid, basically the state of Michigan just says, hey, if we pay it out for you over your lifetime, we're not going to ask anything back right now. But if you pass away, we're now a creditor of your estate because, you know, we've got this amount of money that we paid. And if you have money, we'd like to be paid back.
Right.
So I get it reasonable from their point of view. Right. And then there's also the people want to protect the assets that mom or dad did have, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we also have the reasonable, what can we do to protect those? When we look at estate recovery, we take an individual who's already been on the program. So they've already met eligibility. Their actual assets are very limited.
Correct.
You either have a married person, which they've already transferred all their assets to their spouse, so they're not subject to estate recovery. Or you have a single individual, and let me guess that they probably have four assets, right? They have a prepaid funeral contract,
okay.
that was irrevocable because that's what Medicaid requires. Okay. They have a joint bank account, or maybe they just have a single bank account. A lot of times they'll be joint with a kid, but if it's a single bank account, it's in their name. That bank account shouldn't have any more than $10,000 in it because Medicaid rules. You've got a... maybe a vehicle, one vehicle, because they allow that without counting it. And
okay.
you have a house, maybe, because they allow that. So let's go through those and talk about recovery, right? While prepaid funeral contract pays to the funeral, pays off your funeral, there's no value left over to receive. You've got your bank account. If it's under $10,000, then the state of Michigan allows you to transfer that to next of kin without a probate estate by a small estate affidavit. It's just a little form that you complete.
Okay.
So the joint owner would take, if there's no joint owner, no beneficiaries, then you get to the small estate affidavit and you pass it to the family.
Okay.
Or I guess I should say anyone who inherits under the will is under that one. And then you've got your vehicle. Again, if there's no probate estate, the vehicle can pass by Secretary of State to the next of kin. You just bring a death certificate in, you explain that there's no estate. It has to be lower than $80,000, but God help me if you're on Medicaid with a $100,000
right.
vehicle.
Right.
It's not clever.
Yeah.
And then the last one's your house. And that's why ladybird deeds are so popular, because essentially what you're doing is you're passing it by beneficiary designation to someone. And because you've passed it by beneficiary, it's not going into a probate estate, and the state of Michigan cannot be a creditor outside of the probate estate.
Okay.
So they're just sitting there with no assets to collect from.
Okay.
So good planning is going to avoid the state recovery program, and good planning comes with how you go on to the Medicaid program to begin with. So you should have all your I's dotted, T's crossed before you even get to that point.
Okay. Yeah. Great information. Yeah. Go ahead, Jill.
Yeah. And I think passing on to that house for a lot of our folks is, is something that is very important to the next generation. Mm-hmm. You know, they worked at GM their whole life in the house with the family home. That's where we had Christmas. That's where we had parties. And that is very, I think, very important to a lot of our older folks, because that's their legacy of what they're passing on. So
it's more sentimental in value than people realize. Yes. And when you lose a family member, you start to say, I mean, I'm not upset about the money they want. I'm upset that they want to take the house.
Exactly. Okay. Wow. Great information. Okay. So let's talk about the biggest misunderstanding that you think people have about the difference between Medicare and Medicaid.
I mean, they're so commonly confused, and I don't know why the names are so similar.
I know.
It doesn't
it's
help
true.
Anyone. I think the biggest misconception is their coverage, because it does blend together so easily. When we look at it from the long-term care context, I always use the example of, you know, mom breaks a hip. She falls and breaks a hip, right? Okay. She goes to the hospital, she gets her surgery done, she discharges, she goes to a rehab facility, and what happens next is going to change whether she has coverage or not, because Medicare is a short-term program.
Correct.
They cover what's going on for you right now to an extent of recovery, right? So in that scenario, in that example, she has pretty much between Medicare and her supplemental to that, hopefully she's got a supplemental, she's probably got full coverage all the way through that rehab.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mom's ability to walk after that rehab is now going to fluctuate, okay? Because Medicare is going to say, well, that's as good as you got. Whatever we gave you, you got your rehab, that's where you're at, right? So we don't need to do any more coverage. This is you now. If you can walk, you go home, you go back to your normal life. You don't need any additional coverage. If you can't walk, they say, well, that's a long-term problem. You're going to have that problem the rest of your life, because we tried to rehab you and you didn't get better. So this is you now. And that's a you problem.
Mm.
And so Medicaid is the program that picks up there. And it says, oh, you have an ongoing need every day for the rest of your life. To be able to live your life, you need support.
Mm-hmm.
That's a Medicaid problem. And so that's very different than that hospital stay and discharge to rehab. It is now a ongoing need, and that coverage is a lot bigger, but it's also much more expensive. And the biggest difference between those two programs is that there's a financial needs test, right? Because Medicare, you just got. Mm. Both of them you paid for.
Right.
Both of them you're entitled and have a right to use, which I think people sometimes devalue Medicaid. But one of them you have to prove that you've used, essentially that your resources are depleted, so you need that program to cover the care.
Interesting. Okay, awesome. You've kind of already covered that question, so I'll skip that one. So what do you think makes an attorney a certified specialist in elder law?
I think elder law is just one of those things you learn with your hands into it. So I mentioned I've been around it so long, so I feel very comfortable in it. That being said, estate planners can do documents, but they drafting the document might not understand all the complexities that come out of the language that they add in there. So you want to look for somebody who practices and hopefully is appropriately marketing for specifically elder law, because that's the person who's got their hands in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Their power of attorney is going to tell you this is how you're going to use it once you're actually incapacitated. They're going to be able to carry those things forward. You want someone who's familiar with the Medicaid and Medicare program so that they can advise you. I mean, I always say elder law is very much holistic. It's not just law. It is at least 50% social work.
Yeah.
And hopefully the attorneys who are doing it love that about it, because that's the rewarding piece.
Yeah.
And so you want somebody who's willing to sit down and kind of look at the whole scope of things. Because if I fix one legal issue, there's so much that then affects that client. If right. I get you a conservatorship, right, because somebody needs to manage your resources to pay for care,
mm-hmm.
I should probably have the conversation with you about, where are you going for care? How are you going to use these resources? They're only going to last a year there. Have you thought about Medicaid and how you could utilize that? And should we be planning now? Because Medicaid sometimes takes time to get activated,
mm-hmm.
and all of that. So there's a lot there. So I just would look for an attorney who has experience with it.
Yeah, agree.
Who can meet all of those objectives and not just give you one word answers. They probably don't have enough experience if they can't.
Yeah. And I think even based on what we've talked about just in our short time together today, hopefully people can understand there's so many, you know, caveats and nuances that affect elder care, like you're saying, alive and after you've passed away, that it's important to make sure you've got someone who specializes, just like you would get someone who would specialize in pediatric, you know, care or like you said, special needs care. That's a completely different
thing. And I think there's so many more components to elder law than there's that empathy that families really need someone who's going to listen to them, and they yes. need someone who understands all the different levels of care and understands how the public assets and the private assets, how they can blend together to
yes.
create, fulfill someone's wishes of how they do want to live. We used to talk about that all the time of, you know, it's so many more components than,
mm-hmm.
you know, how whatever document she does really affects their choices
everything
in the long
yeah
run.
And how much peace of mind will you get and have yeah. after having all of this stuff in place? You got all your, like you said, your I's dotted and your T's crossed and everything's in place, and what nice peace of mind that is to have. So huge.
Right. And it's also, I mean, I've come to really appreciate what the family feels as far as the overwhelm stress that comes
yeah.
with just being dropped on top of you, you know, whether it's a disabled child that you had no preparation for, how do I even navigate this world?
Mm.
Or it's an aging parent or loved one. Whoa, you
yeah.
know, I said I'd care for my mom at home. I always knew that I wanted to do that, but God help me. Like, I don't know what it means to manage all of her assets,
right.
to access the care she needs, to
right.
talk to all these people. You know, they're taking their time off of work, FMLA, and
mm-hmm.
so they, like, I can't find enough time in the day to deal with everything I have to.
Right.
So the value of a good elder law attorney should be that you walk in there and you say, everything that I possibly can has now been, you know, explained to me. If I want to pay them to help me with it, then I've got that off my load. And I now have a partner
mm-hmm.
that's able to. I mean, I have so many families who are just like, fix the problem right now, but then we stay in contact for the rest of that person's life because
yeah.
they just need a resource
yeah.
and they don't want to call 10 people to get 10 different questions answered. They want to call one place. And so a good elder law attorney is offering that kind of understanding of what's happening.
Yep.
And same with a social worker. I,
yeah.
you know,
okay, yeah. if you're
a good social worker.
If your elder law firm has social workers, I mean, that's a big green flag. I will say
mm-hmm.
that.
I agree.
Once.
I agree. Yeah. No, that's.
It is such a combination of navigating long-term care, navigating that road, that it takes a team
mm-hmm.
to really help families out sometimes.
Yep. 1,000%. Okay. Let's see. We'll kind of make this our last question for the podcast today. But what do you think is the biggest myth about Medicaid that you encounter?
So I will say, I really, and this is a little bit like I said before, I really think people are so worried about the Medicaid program being in control and taking. And it's this fear that people act on with Medicaid that keeps them from using it. I was just talking to someone the other day about immigrant communities who are so mm-hmm. focused on keeping someone at home, and they're scared of the system
mm-hmm.
changing that goal. And I would hope that a good elder law attorney would really be able to add value to that, because you'd be surprised what our system can do to work for you.
Mm.
And you don't have to take anything you don't want. So if you don't like what the system is offering, you have the ability to say no, but at least explore your options.
Right.
Because so many families suffer alone trying to provide the care because they don't want to welcome in you know, something they think is going to change those choices. So for example, like Medicaid has community programs that pay for care in home and assisted living. And people always think that they're going to be forced towards one direction. Now, certainly income cap on those community programs doesn't help, but the return would be is, okay, so if you're not eligible, now we know, right? Now we know that Medicaid is only going to be in a nursing home. So let's focus on what we can do to keep private resources paying for care as long as we can at home. Or, you know, just VA benefits is one I talk to people a lot about, how that can supplement being able to stay at home. Different resources people might have, if they have more private resources than $10,000 and they don't understand that there are so many planning techniques that attorneys can do to create eligibility. And the goal of that planning isn't just to like stockpile money. It's because a lot of times there's a spouse who needs more than what Medicaid would normally allow. And so planning is able to say, if we have this pool of money, let's keep it for the survivor because one person shouldn't deplete the whole resource. If you have a single person, sometimes we even do gifting planning just because we want to keep the house going and what the Medicaid program is providing isn't enough for them to keep the house able for them to stay home. I mean, there are so many pieces of it that can really benefit. And it's not about you being selfish wanting an inheritance. It's not about you saying, I want to cheat the system and take advantage of a government program. It's not about saying, I'm going to just put my parent into the institution and be systematized. Like, it really just is knowing the information that could potentially support what you were already going to do and make your life easier and make the loved one have the quality of life they want. And God help me, if you come in and you don't like any of the advice, you just walk out of there and you say, okay, now I know. I'm not missing anything. But I think normally people pick up a few different things that are really valuable.
Wow. This has been awesome. This has been really great. You're such a fountain of information. I know the listeners are just going to love this podcast. And Susie, tell us really quickly, how can people get in touch with you if they're interested in coming in a meeting with you?
So Chalgen and Tripp has 8 offices across the state.
Okay.
So if you call any one of the numbers on our website, it will get you to that office. So that's why if you're calling from the East Lansing area, it's 517-332-3800. But, and you can call that and you can schedule anywhere, but that would be the main way is to call and meet with us. Every one of our attorneys is, we all focus in this. So we're very, very educated in it. The other way is the website's out there. There's information on the website. We do have social workers on staff, so you can always call and use a social worker as well. But yeah, you can reach out or.
And the website has some really good articles and resources. It's www.mielderlaw.com is their website. But there's some really good articles on there that if you're just looking for some real good information, that's a great tool for you to start and to start building your toolbox of resources as you navigate long-term care.
And I'm open to questions, especially, you know, and there's other providers out there who ask questions too. I mean, I always feel like it's easier to share information than to let you make a mistake and then come in and pay for it.
So this has been so great. Thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. If you have any questions, feel free to write in, and we will get back to you. But we hope to have Susie back again as we continue our journey on the Rhodes podcast and giving you information about resources that you can use. So thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.